Caroline Lowry interviewing Roy Dunningham on Thursday, the 26th of November 2020. Good morning, Roy. Looking forward to hearing your story.
Good morning, Caroline. Okay, well, I was born in Hastings in 1936. My parents were Wilfred and Tui Dunningham. I was an only child. I went to Parkvale School, which I enjoyed because I had an oddball teacher there, Mr. Harris. Mr. Harris loved Wagnerian opera, art, music, so his spelling tests would be things like, last night the pianist Alfred Cortot held a concert of Schubert's music in the Auckland town. That would be our spelling test. So I loved Mr. Harris, nobody else did, but never mind. And I actually became ducks of Parkvale School. My mother encouraged me in art as well. My family wasn't an educated family, but they encouraged education. I can remember once when I was a kid, my father, who ran a service station, said, you know, well, what are you going to do when you grow up? And so out of loyalty, I said, oh, I'll come into the service station with you, Dad. No, you won't, he said. You know, so though he wasn't educated himself, he had a higher sight for me, and I do appreciate that. I do value that. That was something with that generation, I think. The things that, it's funny, the little things that affect your life. The polio epidemic, for example, of 1948-49, the summer of 48-49, they were marvellous actually, I enjoyed them. Correspondence lessons sent out to us, no online in those days, of course. And I was a bit pipped at the time because I was the only kid in the street who actually did all the exercises, mainly because my mother wouldn't let me go out to play until I'd finished my task for the day. But I can also remember the music appreciation programs on the radio, Owen Jensen. I can still remember the music of Smetana's Moldau, the River Moldau. I can still play it in my head from those days. These things make a deep impression at that age. I suppose sometimes your life hinges on a single event. Well, mine hinged on probably less than a minute, a 30-second chance conversation with a teacher. In 1950, I arrived at Hastings High School, the third form, and they put us into options, and I went into art for 2 weeks. Schools were slow at getting themselves organised in those days. And after 2 weeks, they finalised our options, in inverted commas, and I found myself doing woodwork. Well, you didn't sort of complain about those things in those days. But anyway, a couple of days later, I was walking across the school quadrangle, and I bumped into Miss Guppy, the art teacher. And she must have remembered me from the 2 weeks that I was in her class and must have recognised some talent. And she said, Dunningham, why aren't you in art? And I said, please, Miss Guppy, they made me do woodwork. Did they? She said. And next woodwork period, Miss Guppy comes sailing into the woodwork room, sails up to Bert Garrick, the woodwork teacher, points to me and says, I want that boy in art. And Bert, with indecent haste perhaps, said, take him, he's yours. And everything in my life hinged on that 30-second chance conversation. I mean, my career, my marriage, my family, my friends, the whole shape of my life hinged literally on that 30 seconds. Goodness knows what would have happened otherwise, but that's what shaped it. There were other teachers who influenced me. Miss Guppy, yeah, thank you, Miss Guppy, wherever you are. It sounds a bit mean of me to say that she wasn't actually a very good art teacher, but never mind. Fortunately, she left, and the teacher who replaced her was a lady called Yvonne Rust. And Yvonne Rust was an inspirational art teacher, one of the great art teachers. And I suppose as a teacher eventually myself, to some extent you model yourself on the teachers that you admired. And I guess in lots of ways, I always modelled myself on Yvonne's teaching. She was also, incidentally, I know, a huge role model for a lot of the female students, a number of female students who realised that, you know, a female could be a strong, independent, creative person, that you didn't just have to be an adjunct to a male. And so that was wonderful. The other one who influenced me was Mr. Ede, a wonderful English teacher who gave me a great love of poetry, T.S. Eliot, Shakespeare, Wilfred Owen. Whenever I did any reading to a class, I modelled myself on Mr. Ead. He had a particular technique. He was very intelligent and he understood the words, what they meant, understood them thoroughly, and then understated them, let the words do the work. Mm. And, gee, it was effective. I also played in the first 15, first 11 there, so I enjoyed my school years. Yeah. I thought they were great. In the mid-1950s, I duly arrived at Canterbury Art School. Some great tutors there, Russell Clark, Bill Sutton, again, teachers that you model yourself on in future years. Also experienced how tough business art could be. Another one of the tutors was Rudolf Gopas. Rudy was a Lithuanian refugee, a very good artist and a very outspoken character. And anyway, we used to have monthly sketch club meetings where we'd have a guest speaker, we'd exhibit our paintings, the guest speaker would criticise the paintings, then we'd all go away and have a party afterwards. And Rudy was the guest this night and he spent about 5 minutes verbally demolishing one of my paintings and in broken English, which made it even more devastating. And what made it even worse was the fact I was the president and I had to thank him afterwards. I didn't touch a paintbrush for a couple of weeks afterwards. Oh. I was so shattered. And then I thought, well, you know, if I was that wimpy, I shouldn't be mucking around with it. So that was, oh, yeah. He finished by adding, ah, there is one thing that I like about this painting. The signature is nice. Oh. Anyway, so that was one of life's toughening experiences. Rudy was also, he was a misogynist. He hated female students. And he's infamous for the incident where one female student took a painting to him and he said, ah, this painting is too big. Take it away. Make it smaller. And she did that and he repeated that. No, it's still too big. Make it smaller. And then the third time, now it is small enough to throw in the rubbish bin. So he's pretty destructive. Oh. I didn't like Rudy. But anyway, the really great thing, I guess, at art school was the student flat. My memory of that is so colourful. There's a painting in the by Phil Claremont in the Hawke's Bay Museum of a flat, and a seedy flat just like that. And it's all Phil Claremont, brilliantly coloured. And, of course, our flat was faded, furniture torn, stained and so on. But I remember the flat, the way that Phil Claremont painted this picture, because the people that went through, the debates and discussions we had, the art, the music, the poetry and so on, it was vividly coloured. It was exciting and wonderful. And the great thing was, of course, I met the love of my life, Marie, and that was the beginning of a 60-year love affair, which was wonderful. We married and I began teaching my first teaching job at Te Kuiti. Our four children were born there. Te Kuiti was actually a great experience because this was in the days before drugs and gangs, and country towns still had an innocence about them. There was a social life there too, because this was the days when the banks and the stock agents still had agencies there. So you had young people on their way up through the ranks, country service and school. So there was really quite a vibrant young social circle in those towns. And being an intellectual in a small town, I was able to, I did stage sets, I had art shows, I took lead roles in stage productions, I sang, I was part of the, I've actually sung on stage with Kiri Te Kanua.
Wow.
It was a fundraising tour that she did and we put on an event for her, and so I was on stage with her singing, so I'll claim it. And I also played in the local rugby and cricket team, so you could be everything. I mean, it was the big frog in the small pond, but it was fun. I played rugby against the great Colin Meads.
Wow.
I actually tackled him once, and I think in actual fact I fell over and he tripped over me, but never mind. So, however, you need to change, and Te Kuiti was a small school. Friends move on, and I wanted to move to a larger centre that had more of an art community, and a job came up at Hastings Boys High School, which I took, and that was a good move because I had some exciting classes and exciting students there. people like Phil Judd, for example, of Split Ends, who also has a painting into Papa. Mark Huff, who founded the Suburban Reptiles and foundation member of the Swingers, Counting the Beat. That was actually fun. And again, stage sets. I love stage design. And we had two very good drama producers at Hastings Boys, Peter McMacken and Bert McConnell. And plays like Royal Hunt of the Sun, Ross, Macbeth, Merchant of Venice, and a number of students who actually ended up, people like Stuart Devinney and so on, who became professional actors themselves. That was actually pretty exciting. I also did a number of sets for group theatre at that time. Plays like Man for All Seasons, Under Milkwood and so on. Theatre design, it was sort of total art. You had everything there. You had sound, you had movement, you had gesture, you had shapes and design and form. It was the whole thing. And I loved designing for a purpose. If I had my time over again, knowing what I know now, I'd be tempted to be a graphic designer because I love the idea of having a set problem and having to solve that problem. On the other hand, I love teaching anyway, so teaching the most rewarding occupation, and it means so much to me that I'm still friends with people that I taught so long ago. It's pretty wonderful. Anyway, okay. At Hastings Boys High School, I also got interested in tramping, and I ended up taking the school tramping club. And I can remember an incident there that defines how narrow the gap is between life and death. One of my friends, an intermediate school teacher, asked me to take his class for a tramp. So we went to climb 4100 in the Carwickers, and we came down the shingle slides, lovely shingle slide, you glissade your way down. And right at the very bottom, one of the girls took a little tumble. She didn't go more than 2 or 3 metres. She could have tumbled playing netball at school. But anyway, she was quite dazed. She was pale. The pupils of eyes were dilated, and she complained about a sore tummy, and you don't like to go prodding around the tummy of a teenage girl, of course. Anyway, she said she really couldn't walk, and so I took it at face value, and we had plenty of adults, we made up a stretcher, carried her out all the way to the road, got her to hospital just in time to save her from a ruptured spleen. So all these little bits of drama that come in. I suppose the hunting interest also introduces what you might call a dark incident or a period in my life. Somebody introduced me to a man called Terry Clark. Now, Terry had a pine tree pruning contract at Willow Flat up at Moorhaka, and he wanted somebody to go pig hunting with him. I should have had warning bells that none of the Maori boys who worked for him would go out with him. That should have been a warning, but never mind. Somebody told him, well, I know somebody who's brave enough, silly enough, Roy Dunningham. Anyway, Terry was great company, charming man. I started to realise he was a bit dodgy. He admitted that he'd been a crook, a burglar in Auckland, and had come down here to go straight. And in those days, it was the late 60s, and, you know, you sort of had these romantic ideas that baddies really had good people inside wanting to get out. Terry was interesting. His marriage had broken up, but he had custody of the children. God knows the story behind that. And actually, the children and Terry have sat at the same table having me. We became quite good friends. Anyway, I realised that he was still a bit dodgy when, on the way home from Willow Flat, he said he was running short of petrol. And so he stopped and said, tell me if somebody comes. And there were some cars parked. And he comes out with a hitch of rubber tube. And I'm just about dying of fright there. Anyway, I realised the friendship started to cool. He also had a partner at the time who looked after his children. Norma Fleet was her name. Norma, actually, she was a good lady, somebody who only hurt herself. And she really looked after the kids well, but she was a heroin addict. And a couple of times when Terry was up at Willow Flat, I had to rescue. She'd ring me up, and she was having withdrawal symptoms, and so I'd have to go out to Hamuana, where she lived, and take her and the kids up to the Esk Valley to where her sister lived to look after her. Anyway, yeah, the friendship ended, but the final incident was when Terry must have decided there wasn't enough money in pine tree pruning, and he burgled the Manchester Unity safe in Hastings. But the really bad thing was that he used an oxyacetylene he'd stole from the metalwork room in Hastings Boys High School. The cops found out that I'd been friendly with him, and so I got grilled by the cops.
Oh.
I got the bad cop, good cop treatment.
Right.
And then, you know, the sergeant got a phone call, and the other cop said, look, Roy, we don't want to nail you, you know, we just want to... I know nothing. Anyway, that was the end of the friendship with Terry Clark. And, of course, Terry in jail realised that you could make more money from drugs than you could from burglary, and ended up, of course, in the Mr. Asia gang, murdered 4 people in Australia at least, probably murdered Norma Fleet when she'd outlived her usefulness. She died of a heroin overdose in a motel in Martin, and it's almost certain that Terry did that. Murdered Marty Johnson, the leader of the Mr. Asia gang, because he was unreliable. And then got murdered himself, probably in jail. He was probably an informant to the prison authorities on the IRA.
It was in England, wasn't it?
It was in England, yeah. Well, he got away with it and things in Australia. And Australian cops, of course, at that time, and even now they're pretty dodgy, were notoriously corrupt. But in England, they nailed him. And he officially died of a heart attack, but probably the IRA sat on his chest so he couldn't read. But anyway, that was my the dark episode. And Terry was a charming psychopath. Yeah. Anyway, and round about that time, I guess you also have great tragedy in your life. First tragedy in our life, stillborn baby, our baby Tom died. But we fought our way through that. And it was a time of, I was showing in art groups at the time, and I went to a wonderful 4-day school with Colin McCann. He was actually the greatest teacher I've ever met. You know, they say those who teach, you know, but in actual fact, McCann was the best. The 4 days I spent with him was the most intense learning experience of my life. It's been with me ever since. And was after that that I shifted to Havelock North High School. Again, I'd enjoyed my time at Boys High, but Havelock North was a new school. I wanted to teach in a co-ed school. It had more scope for the arts, and it was a highly motivated staff, a new school. It was pretty exciting. I ended up with the biggest art department in Hawke's Bay, and it was tremendously satisfying, actually. The number of students who I still keep in touch with today, the students who went on to become professional artists in some way themselves. The school had a great music department and very strong drama. So again, the stage sets were important. West Side Story, Camelot. West Side Story was interesting. The sets for that, I decided it was written in the 50s, abstract expressionism, you know, Jackson Pollock. So I thought, well, I'll do some huge Jackson Pollocks and scaffold. I won't try to recreate New York City. I'll put up scaffolding around the stage, and I'll put up these huge Jackson Pollock type paintings. And so it was a long weekend. I got a couple of senior students to help me, and I thought, this is going to be easy, we'll just chuck paint everywhere. And it didn't work. And I found that I had to think, right, we need a wash of green there, we need an arc of black there. And so what Jackson Pollock would have done just intuitively, I had to nut it out to get something that actually looked cogent, that actually worked. And so I should have known that, of course, but it was a good learning experience for me and for the students. It was a time of changes to art assessment, where instead of sitting an exam, you sent in folios by this stage. And I was appointed to national marking panels and school C, UE and bursaries.
So this was in the 70s?
By this time we're in the 70s, the late 70s, early 80s, yeah. And that was quite exciting too, because I was working with some of the leading artists in the country. And of course, this was the time when students were encouraged to latch onto the style of leading artists and to learn from them and incorporate that artist in their own work. And so I was marking with artists who were represented amongst the students' work. And I can record it was bursary art, I think. And the sculptor, Greer Twiss, there were Elam lecturers there, and he found a student who'd based his work on Don Binney's. And he calls out to Don Binney across the marking room, "Hey, Don, this kid does your stuff better than you do." Some interesting things happened. I reckon I scored something that would have been a New Zealand record for results in bursary. I had a student in bursary who the year before in my sixth form class, I'd failed him because he was very bright but very lazy, and he'd missed so many deadlines that I failed him. He said, look, I know I bombed last year. Can I do bursary, sir? Yeah, all right. I've had faith in him. And he was superb, absolutely superb. He ended up getting 96% for bursary. So he actually, his bursary mark was twice the mark, double the mark of the year before. Wow. That's got to be a national record. He became a very successful architect later. In the 1980s, I became involved with what was then the Hawke's Bay Art Gallery and Museum, now MTG, of course. I was appointed a board member, and I was also appointed on an acquisitions committee, and that was interesting because the museum had missed out on that period of the 60s and 70s when all these vibrant new artists, yeah. Claremont, Fomerson and so on, Maddox and so on, they didn't purchase anything of their work in that time. So by the 1980s, we were in catch-up mode, still trying to get enough money together to get some of those artists while we still could. And I can remember that we had a chance to buy Tony Fomerson's painting of Omai. Omai was the young Tahitian who joined Cook's expedition, went back to UK. It's a wonderful painting. Anyway, we had this huge argument on the acquisitions committee. We fought World War III over it and finally managed to convince them that we bought it for $9,500. It's one of the greatest Fomerson's ever. Art and Object, 4 or 5 years ago, valued it at $450,000. So that sort of thing was fun, and at least we made up some ground on that. I started doing curating work at this stage. I curated shows for the Hawke's Bay Art Gallery on Brian Dew. Brian Dew was an interesting artist in the 1960s. He did a series of bitingly satirical paintings of Hawke's Bay social life. The Blossom Queens, you know, the parade of flesh and the leering old men putting award medals around their necks, you know, that sort of thing. The awkwardness of 21st birthday parties, all the social mores of the time. And sadly, Brian left, went and worked in America, finally became a graphic designer. But these paintings are a terrific record of Hawke's Bay social life at that time. So I curated a show of that in the late 1980s for the Hawke's Bay Museum. One on Phil Simmons, pioneer modernist. Another one on Brian Dew for Hawke's Bay Exhibition Centre. One on Jeff Fuller. Jeff Fuller was really a tremendously important art teacher at Karamu High School and then an artist in one of the most, probably the major figure in Hawke's Bay art over much of the latter part of the 20th century. And so it was really great to be able to do a retrospective exhibition of his work. The collector's room, that was paintings from local collections. I borrowed a painting from Your Name Lowry.
Jamie and Prue?
That's right. I borrowed a painting from them. Bronwyn Thorpe and I did that. Okay, I'm into modern times now. And by this time, I'd given up painting myself. I had too many interests. I didn't have the discipline to dedicate myself. I wasn't doing it well enough. And I thought, rather than do it badly, I'd rather concentrate effort on mentoring others. So I curated, I advised things. I became an art advisor for the Hastings City Art Gallery, planning their future exhibitions. I did a lot of writing on art. I wrote for many years when the Hawke's Bay Herald Tribune used to have serious articles on art in those days. I wrote for Bay Buzz magazine. I wrote several articles for Art News New Zealand. I set up a business as a consultant, fitting for individual clients with an artwork. I did a number of mural and glass windows designs for National Mutual in Napier and a couple of finance companies in Hastings. I did a glass window for Sacred Heart. They were commissions for architects. So it was going quite nicely. I'd retired from teaching in 1996, incidentally. Yeah, I decided that I was still teaching well at that stage, and it was a matter of pride. I'd seen it at Hastings Boys High School. I could remember the old chalkies who were sad men, you know, their careers dissolving around them. And no, I didn't want to be like that. No. So I retired while I was still alive and kicking. I did consultancy work for Opus on the local district plan and as an art advisor for the Hastings District Council. So all the sculptures that we have in the CBD in Hastings and in Havelock North came from that. So that was pretty exciting. Right. Yeah, and we actually got a national award for that. Hastings City Council were great. We sold them on the idea that Hastings was never going to be River City, City of the Seven Hills, Venice of the South. So we had to make it interesting and give it a vibrancy in some other way. And so that was one way of doing that. We had to concentrate on what we did in the town, seeing that it didn't have the natural attributes. I curated a number of shows for Russell Street Art Centre as well. But then in year 2000, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer. And so I decided it was time to enjoy life then. And so my wife and I had already travelled a bit, but we embarked on serious travel. I was successfully treated with radiotherapy. And so that gave me a bonus lease on life. So there was a lot of travelling there to Australia, Europe, Asia. And the wonderful exhibitions, Mark Rothko, Jackson Pollock, Monet, Picasso, Max Beckman, just so exciting. And even Australian art. Marie had relatives and family in Australia. I love the Australian colonial art, the Heidelberg School in Victoria, beautiful paintings. But I also love the contemporary indigenous art there. Boy, is it angry, and with very, very good reason, of course. Yeah. But the intensity of the anger, I'd never seen anything like that before.
So that was in the colour or the...
Everything, the messages, the content. Mm. I mean, we see powerful work by Maori activist artists in New Zealand and, you know, fine, it's vibrant, but it's tame compared with these artworks just vibrated, they exuded anger. Which was not a relaxing, pleasant experience, but my goodness, it was exciting and revealing. It probably told more than anything just where things are at present and things are not at a good stage yet. Yeah. Okay. In 1999, my wife and I bought a block of bushland in the Ruahinis. And we own the headwaters of the Manawatu River, actually.
Wow.
So that was pretty exciting. So that was a lot of work improving, building a hut and improving a hut, cutting tracks, pest control, possums and mustelids, dope growers. We had a dope grower using our land and somebody broke into our hut. So I took a couple of big mates around to the dope grower's house, you know, accusing him of breaking into our hut. And he was very indignant at that. He admitted growing dope on our land, but said he didn't break into huts. He said, that's kid stuff. I'm a professional. Yeah, you couldn't argue with that. It's an exciting block of land. We have a stand of this regenerating bush there. A lot of it was milled. But there is a stand of rimu trees, which are at least 500 years old. You know, they were there when the Armada sailed. They were already reasonable-sized trees. We've covenanted that land. So that's great to know that, you know, when we're long gone, it's still going to be there. Still active in art activities. For the best part of the last 20 years, I've taken U3A groups, University of the Third Age.
Yes, yes.
And they've been a marvellous, marvellous group, a lovely group of people. They're never daunted by anything. We do a gallery visit. I didn't want to stand in a room and show slides, so we go to a gallery every month. And that was really good for me because it means that I have to adjust to new work, challenging work, and even if I don't like it, I have to be able to say something cogent about it at least. And so that kept me awake. I was also in an advisory group for the Hastings City Art Gallery for a number of years, planning the exhibitions that were upcoming. I've been a guest speaker for a number of MTG functions. Oh, I did neglect to mention, I've had three tragedies in my life. My daughter Helen died way back in the late 1980s. That was the second tragedy, our youngest daughter. And then 2018, my wife died after a short illness. Then 2019, my own health declined quite seriously. Fortunately, I responded well to chemotherapy and back into action. I've compiled a book of my wife's poetry. My wife was a remarkable lady. Our relationship could be stormy at times. Neither of us was backward and coming forward if something pissed us off. But at the same time, we were never bored with each other. And she was quite an activist. She was head of Grey Power locally. She was an activist in social, political matters, environmental matters, Cape Kidnappers Protection, that sort of. She was a fluent speaker of Te Reo, and she was a very good poet and a leading light in the local live poets. And so anyway, I compiled and printed a book of her poetry. So that was my big tribute to her. I returned to my U3A group, and I selected a major show this year for Community Arts Napier. I made a film for MTG on their permanent collection. So right now I'm thinking about what the next thing I'll do will be.
Oh, exciting. Tell me, COVID, how have you found that?
Not too bad. I was an only child. Mm. And so one of the few advantages of being an only child was that you're self-reliant. I mean, in war years, when I was a kid, we didn't have many toys available for sale. And so I can remember I used to make my own toys. I'd make my own aeroplanes, trucks, guns, whatever. That was fun. That ability to improvise has actually been really useful. I got a commission in the army when I did compulsory military service because they set you up where they want you to take a model lesson. This is on the officer's trainee course. And they say, you know, we'll give you these resources to take your lesson. And anyway, the lesson comes along and suddenly you're told, oh, sorry, we can't give you the resources, we can't find the key, and so on. And so I was able to improvise a brilliant lesson out of nothing and ended up First Lieutenant Dunningham. That was the improvisation of those wars. So COVID, I was compiling my wife's poetry book at that time, which was a terrific experience because it was like hearing her speaking to me. So it's a great memento.
Fantastic.
Yeah. You renew contacts with friends that maybe you've drifted away from. Mm. Yeah, COVID was okay for me. It was okay. Yeah.
Oh, good. Well, that was fascinating. Thank you so much. Can't wait to listen to it. Thanks so much, Roy.